The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Laura Kovacs. I'm the executive producer of Author Events, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. For Lydia Bastianich, the godmother of Italian-American cuisine, sharing food is a way to connect and nurture. She is the author of more than a dozen beloved culinary guides, owner of celebrated Italian restaurants in Manhattan, Pittsburgh, and Kansas City, and an Emmy Award-winning public television host. An array of honors across her remarkable career includes several James Beard Awards and induction into the Culinary Hall of Fame. She last visited the Free Library with her 2019 memoir titled My American Dream, and she joins us this evening with her new cookbook, Lydia's From Our Family Table to Yours. Tonight is doubly special, as Ms. Bastianich will be joined in conversation with Heather Merrill Thomason, named one of Food & Wine magazine's 15 visionaries who will revolutionize the way we eat, and the founder of Philadelphia's Primal Supply Meats. Please welcome our guests to the Free Library.
I'm just a little bit nervous because we have Lydia.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lydia, do you remember what it felt like the first time you met Julia Child? Were you nervous? Because I think
I was.
That's how I feel now.
I was nervous, but the setting, maybe I need to just put it in a setting. It was when I opened for Lydia. So I started my first restaurant in 1971. In Queens, I was rather young with my husband. We opened one restaurant, then was doing fine. We opened another little one. We sold those, and after 10 years, you know, because I wasn't a chef from the beginning. I cooked, but I didn't have any real professional training in the sense. So in those first 10 years, I entered the kitchen, became the sous chef to the chef that we hired, and by 81, I was ready. Now, in 81, we opened for Lydia, which was on 58. We sold the other two, we opened for Lydia. And there I became the chef. But also, the difference was that, you know, when I came to the States, the Italian cuisine in the States was different than in America. It's the Italian-American cuisine. And it's a great cuisine, delicious, but it's different. For those of you that have been to Italy, you know that each region in Italy is quite different. And the food is different. And I said, well, you know, I think maybe I'll really will cook like we cook at home, the regional food of Italy. I did sort of combine a little bit of the Italian-American. So 81, this young American woman, chef, cooks this strange Italian regional food. And, you know, who is she? So I was kind of a curious item on the block. And journalists, of course, but Julia Child also wanted to come and see. And she called for a reservation, and I knew she was coming. But, you know, would you have to understand that at that point in my life, I didn't understand the magnitude also of Julia, you know? I knew, I watched her on television and whatever, she came in, so I was ready, you know, she came in on her reservation, and she walks in with James Beard. So the two of them, you know, both very big individuals. And they came in, and, you know, they looked at the menu. I wanted to talk. So was I really, really nervous? I was nervous because I was nervous just, you know, in the restaurant. This was about 6 or 7 months into the opening. But as I said, I didn't know how grand or big or whatever she was. So I kind of, we started talking. She wanted to know about risotto. She wanted to have risotto. She came back. She had risotto again, and ultimately she wanted me to teach her how to make it. So we became friends. And actually, being on television is due to her, because she invited me to be on her show, which was the MasterChef series. And the producer said, after we were finished with two episodes, she said, oh, Lydia, you're pretty good. How about a show of your own? And that's how, you know, and we were talking in the back about our profession and how does one, especially being a woman, how do you grow? How do you make things happen? And, you know, I guess you have to identify opportunities and take them, but you have to be ready to, in a sense, to take them. And I don't know if I was ready or not, but I said, I'm going, sure, why not? But I asked for two things, that I be on PBS and that we film it in my home, because I was not used to studios, cooking in studios, yeah. So till this day, now we still film the show in my home.
I love this. I mean, I think your risotto is actually what made you famous. It's what Julia wanted to learn from you. I had such a good time. I was looking through the various New York Times reviews of Felidia over the years, and Mimi Sheraton came there, and Ruth Reichel wrote a beautiful, beautiful review. 15 years after you opened, she was still talking about how New Yorkers and Americans weren't really ready for the real Italian food that you were cooking. Right. And I read a review from Frank Bruni, and he said something like, talking about a beet and goat cheese, I believe, a Humboldt Fog risotto that you made for him, and he said, a risotto like that could put pasta out of business.
Well, you know, the risotto, because when I started in 71, now to make good risotto, you need the short grain rice. Now there's more than 1,000 different species of rice. You know, rice is the most common food in the world. It fed the most amount of people in the world than any other food. So it's been around for a while. But to make a good risotto, you need a short grain rice, whether it's Canaroli or Arborio. And the short grain rice, the qualities of it is that when you slowly cook it and you have the right technique, the starches seep out. And that's what makes the risotto creamy. So when I first opened in 71, the first restaurant, there was no short grain rice in America. No, we only had the old Uncle Ben's, the long grain. And I know my father, he loved risotto, and he insisted on making risotto, my mother and I, whatever I would help. And every time he ate it, he says, but this is not the same. He said, of course it's not, it's a different rice. So it was difficult even for restaurants to do the risotto. Not only the technique is unique, because you have to, it's simple, but it's unique, but they didn't have the product. And so when I opened Felidia in 81, by then we were beginning to get the short grain rice. And
I didn't even think about that part, that the risotto is like, you have to take all this time and care, and you have to keep serving it, stirring it, and you have to serve it right away. So in your restaurant, you would, for 20 minutes, would you stand at the stove to serve the perfect risotto?
Yeah, you made it at ordinary time for whenever the order came in. And you had a little pot. And it was difficult also because you have a little pot. Let's say that you have a restaurant that sits 70 people or 80 people, and five of them order risotto. In five little pots, five fires are you know. So I remember the chefs always used to get mad at the waiters. Can't you suggest the same risotto to another table? Don't bring me one with seafood, one with mushrooms. Suggest the same one so I can make them together.
I love hearing these stories. I was really hoping to kind of go back here with you. So I loved learning that, you know, you owned and operated two restaurants before you really became a chef, in the sense that it wasn't until Felidia, your third restaurant, where you are a chef in the sense that you are, it's your own vision and it's your cooking, and it is 1981, and you're serving Americans who think Italian food is pizza and pasta, and you're serving them risotto and polenta with calf's liver. And I think to myself, like, oh, she is so brave. Like, that is so courageous. But I don't know, you're telling me this Julia story, and maybe it's just like, it's just you being you. Maybe that is the benefit, is that you didn't know how big the stage would become.
Partly is that, yes. You don't really realize, you know, what's in front of you. You just forge ahead with a knowledge, a belief that you have. And, you know, if you think if all of Italy, all of these years, ate this food, and everybody loves coming to Italy, and it must be good, so I'm going to cook it. Sooner or later, they're going to like it. And so on that premises, but I was also quite conscious of the sort of the, could be a little bit of discrepancy. So I would cook chicken parmigiana things, give them those options. But you know what I did, Heather? I did that a lot of times I would cook things like we had friends that were hunters, and they would bring whole venison or whatever. Now you can't, you know that Europe, which you can't do that. But we used to get wild meat in there, and I would make this guazzetto, this sauce with venison. And with it, I would make some polenta, and that's very traditional in the area that we come from. You know, it's winter. My grandfather was a hunter, you know, whether it was a hare or a little deer or something, and the polenta would always go with it. And I would make it, and whatever they ordered, I would bring a little plate on the side of polenta and venison. I said, you got to taste this. This is good. So I would kind of bring it to the, and I think, you know, people built a sense of comfort.
And trust.
And trust.
Yeah, I love that. That you had to kind of slowly introduce them and sort of bring them over to what is your true Italian cooking.
Exactly, yeah.
So, okay, so not only in the 1980s are you groundbreaking, that is really what you were doing, whether you realized it or not, by cooking this authentic Italian food, but you're also a woman. And, you know, you're a woman chef succeeding in a male-dominated field, which I can relate to as a female butcher.
I bet.
Who were your mentors at the time? Like, who were women that you were looking up to?
Well, my I would say my passion eventually, what I became, actually started when I was a child. So you see, maybe I'll explain a little bit. You read my biography. So where I was born in Istria. Istria is no longer Italy. It is now Croatia. But it is, if you go up by Venice, right across the sea there, there's a little peninsula, and now it is Croatia. After World War II, Italy lost the war, and that part was part of the Paris Treaty, the settlement of the aftermath of the war, who gets what. And that part, Istria, was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. And I was just born around that time. So it was a difficult time also for food, for everything. And even though we were Italian, communism came, they changed our name. You know, when you're on a border, wherever in the world you are on a border, you're not just one ethnicity. You are what you feel in the house, that's Italian. But you also connect to the other ones. We spoke the other two languages. We spoke a little bit of Slavic. We spoke a little bit of German because the Austro-Hungarians were also there, and so we were behind the Iron Curtain, and we had to speak Croatian. My mother was a school teacher. She was she had to go in the Communist Party. That's part of why we left also. My father was in prison because he was a mechanic, but he had two little trucks, and he was deemed a capitalist. So there were a lot of things that, and my parents put my brother and I with my grandmother, who was a little bit on the outskirts of the big city of Pula, and she would supply the food for everybody. So we had, in the courtyard where I live, we had chicken, we had ducks, we had geese, we had rabbits, we had goats, we had two pigs every year. And this was all produced the food for the family. And, you know, I was the little helper, the runner around. I wasn't, but I would help. I remember when we had the slaughter of the pigs and all that, the first thing that my grandmother did is, you know, with the pot there, catching the blood. And we would do the blood sausages. And, you know, I was little. They would give me a wooden spoon, and I would mix, and she would put in there some raisins, and she would put in some cornmeal and whatever. So I was around. You know, she would say, okay, go get me the rosemary, go get me the bay leaves, go get the tomato, the potatoes out of, and I would go with the potatoes out of the ground. You know, this was just, I was involved, goats, milking goat, we made ricotta, you know, all of these things. I was involved somewhat, not intentionally, just as a helper, and that was the beginning of my I recorded all of those, evidently, I recorded all of those flavors in this, at that age, and my library of all these flavors is still with me. I still, when we finally escaped back into Italy, and my parents, of course, didn't tell us that we were going, and I realized that I hadn't said goodbye to Grandma because, you know, it was a secret sort of a situation, and food, a while back then, I remember, why did I cook all this food? Why did I, even in Italy with my with the aunt and whatever, cook this food? It was because food brought me back to Grandma, to that place. And so, you know, my connection to food has remained with me. I still, you know, I am who I am and I express myself with cooking for people, nurturing people, and bring me back to a beautiful place when I was a small child.
So you never really felt sort of lonely, I guess, as a woman among men, because you had these strong women that brought you up, and it sounds like you carried them with you.
Well, you know, it was a little bit strange being a woman, especially I noticed it more from the outside than from me, you know, because in Italy, a woman is in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Even in the osterias or trattorias that you go, the husband is out drinking and saying hello to everybody. The woman is in the kitchen cooking. So, you know, I mean, it wasn't a big revelation for me. I think what I had the protection also my husband, because my husband was the one that really wanted to open a restaurant. He was also an immigrant, and he came here, he worked in restaurants, and ultimately that's when we opened the restaurant. And I said, well, I'll help you. But along the way, I mean, when I was in Italy, we were in a refugee camp, and I went to school with the nuns. I ended up in the kitchen because to subsidize my schooling, pay for it. So they put me in the kitchen. That was my first commercial kitchen. And so on, when we came to the States, you know, I was, I think when I was 14, we lived across the street from Walken's Bakery, which was mm-hmm. Christopher Walken. And, you know, I was always kind of a big girl, and I applied. I wanted a job, a part-time job in the bakery, selling or whatever. And they took me, so I worked in the bakery for quite a few years. That's why I'm still friends with Christopher and the family. And I got in the bakery. Not only did I sell and whatever, but I ended up in the back.
Did you learn to bake?
Decorating was more because, you know, they did a lot of the baking. What I ended up doing was when all the bakers went home and whatever, somebody came in, needed a birthday cake or needed this. So I would pipe and I would add. So I got that. So along the way, I always ended up working. But in the restaurant, I had the protection, I guess, of my husband, the family. But, you know, And being a woman also, you know, I say this because I get asked a lot. I never felt that a profession has gender. You know, I never felt, you know, I'm a woman, I can't do that.
Yeah.
And I always tell all the women, I says, you've got to be the best that you can at what you want to do. If you have passion, invest in yourself, become the best, go out there, and don't look at the gender. Don't, you know, just do it. And I think that your work, your product will speak for itself. I remember we had, you know, you do a lot of, in our industry, you do a lot of fundraising, and I know that you do, you're involved in a lot in the community. And these fundraisers, ultimately, all these French chefs with the toque came out, you know, and I never had a toque. I never wore a toque because,
They're so silly. They're so silly.
I felt a little bit, but you know, I was kind of, you know, I felt good about what I was doing. I loved it. At the end of every event, they all came to eat my stuff. So, you know, that reaffirmed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That reaffirmed. I'm still friend. I saw Jacques the other day. We're still friend with all of those French.
I get the impression that you have always had a very strong sense of yourself and who you are, and that comes through in your food too. So I think it's carried you a long way.
I think that, you know, you have to sort of believe in what you do. If you have a passion, I feel that, you know, I was given a gift. The gift is not mine to keep. I need to make the best out of it and bring it out there, whether it is to feed my family or to do a profession as I do. I felt always, also, you know what, is the route of my life, you know, being under communism, the difficulties, then being 2 years in a refugee camp, then ultimately coming to the United States, that was in 1958, I was 12 years old, and we didn't have anybody here. The Catholic charities brought us here. So, you know, all of that, they're all hurdles to overcome in one's life. And I think that they build strength, you know. If you don't give in to them, you know, a lot of people say, Lydia, oh my God, all that you passed, aren't you angry at the past? I says, no. You know, I am who I am because I, you know, each hurdle made me stronger.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you some more cooking questions. Okay. Sort of. So one of the things I love about your food is that you have this deep connection to ingredients always. It's very Italian. But with that also, your food is always seasonal. And you've always appreciated whole animals. You know, you cook with the offcuts and you serve organ meats and things like that. Do you feel like people really appreciate or understood that when you were doing it in the 80s? And has that developed? Or just talk a little bit about that.
I think, you know, I was raised in that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Sunday grandma decided to do a chicken. Saturday we would chase the chicken around there. You know, I would corner it, she would catch it. And on the wooden stump, she would, you know. But she would use everything from the chicken. You know, she would make a big pot of soup, the legs and everything. And I vividly remember as a child, because, you know, as a child, it's impressive. You know, the chickens kind of dig. And so under the nail, they have, and no matter how much you wash, that never comes off. So she used to put their hands like and chop off all the fingernails, and then the rest of the foot, and the head and the neck and everything went into a soup, a nice soup, and she would collect the fat and all that, and that skin, everything that went on. And then the rest she would make a sauce, and she would make either gnocchi or fresh pasta on Sunday. So I was, you know, grown up. For Easter, you know, especially around the time, we didn't eat all that. You respected the animals. You didn't have that much meat. You know, the two pigs had to last for a whole year in different cuts, whether it was in pancetta or sausages or whatever. But Easter, you know, I said we had goats, and goats have little kids, and us, we used to play with the kids because kids are very, the goats are very funny. But, you know, then Easter came with the spring, and there it was, you know, hanging and being skinned and all of that. And you kind of respect, you know, I have a great respect for these animals because these are animals, you know, you love them, you feed them, and ultimately they keep you alive. They kept us alive at the time of that. So I think when I came to the States, and going in, although in Astoria they had butchers, and this is a neighborhood, they had butchers, and we had the Italian butchers, and they had tripe, and they had liver, and all of that. So it wasn't completely separated from that. But in the stores, in the regular grocery stores, everything was packaged and was, you know, either pieces. Although I remember necks and wings being there, because that's what my mother bought. You know, they were the cheapest, and punch of necks would make a big pot of soup.
And the wings are the most delicious.
And then we would nibble on them with a little salt. Yeah, yeah. So I think that maybe the American sort of culinary sentiments are coming back to that reality of, you know, what do we need as food? What do we treat it right? Does that, because also, rabbits, you know, my grandmother had rabbits, and she kept the male always separate. When she needed rabbits, she put the male together with the girls, and we had more food, right? I mean, there was a whole pattern going on, you know. But I tried in every restaurant, even in this book, I have a rabbit recipe. Rabbits is delicious, good meat, no fat, basically no fat. A rabbit is very environmentally kind of friendly because, two months, you have from a baby, you have a mature rabbit, and you can eat, you know, feed with a rabbit a family of 10 people, no problem. You know, I mean, if you make a sauce. And they don't consume all that much of our environment, you know, grass or whatever. So if you really are conscious about the environment and everything else, then these kind of things should be looked at. If you want every day a big steak on your path, you know, it takes a cow, 3 years to develop to full.
Yeah.
And all how much grain and grass and all of that they have to eat to produce that steak. So I think that that's the point. We rarely ate, beef or something like that. We only, when the animal was a certain age, and then it was only good for soup or for braisings or goulash or things like that. And I think that the industrial situation, revolution actually here, when the women went to work and whatever, and big industry set in and began to prepare food for Americans to eat. I think that's when everything changed. And even now, big industry, there's a lot of money. The food industry is the second largest employer in the United States. So, you know, you can't just shut it off. You know, how you have to change the mentality of all of us, how you buy. And this is what's going to drive any change, and it's a slow change. Because, you know, the big industry, they have lobbies, they have everything, there's a lot of money in this. So it's who's right, who's wrong, whatever, we slowly have to be cautious, as America is ever more.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, when I speak, the one thing that I can say is your money can make the change. Buy the right thing. You know, buy whether it's organic, whether it's buy the next, buy something. Buy it, use it all, and let your money speak for you.
I absolutely agree. I always say that, you know, thank you. You vote with your dollars. For every dollar that you spend with a farmer and not with the big industry, that's you saying that you want more of that. Mm-hmm. And it's important. So I really do appreciate that for 25 years now, you know, beyond the restaurant, but as a cooking show host and someone that so many people listen to, that this is something that you believe in so truly and speak about. It means a lot to me.
Well, we have to. We see where the world is
it's
going.
The future.
We have to do it.
So I want to talk a little bit more about your cooking because I had so much fun this week preparing for this. I spent a lot of time on YouTube watching some of your old cooking shows. I found that original MasterChef episode of you making the risotto for Julia, and you have her to your home, and Felice is playing the accordion, and it is magical. You're singing.
Well, let me tell you. So you know, in Italy, when you eat at the end, you sing. So, you know, it's everybody's happy, especially if there's holidays or something. My husband did play the accordion. He would bring it out. And we were singing sort of traditional Italian song. Let me tell you, she was swaying and singing with us. She didn't know the words, but she was into it.
You must find this. It is online, and it's beautiful. But so I'm watching, some of your earlier the earliest of your own PBS show, and I noticed that you cook some traditional Italian recipes that you've introduced people to. I love the episode with your mother where you're making the monkfish brodetto, and she's talking about eating polenta, and it's beautiful. So things like that is like probably very foreign to most Americans at that time. But also, you know, you have episodes where you're cooking meatballs, and you talk about how that is Italian-American and not something from Italy. And, you know, me now, looking at your whole history of cooking, I feel like you've slowly developed your very individual style of cooking. It's kind of a hybrid now of Italian, traditional Italian and Italian-American. Do you feel like maybe in the 90s when you were very important on PBS, trying to make Italian food accessible to Americans, were you leaning into the Italian-American cooking more, or do you think it's more just you becoming more American in time?
No, it was just realizing the situation and appreciating And knowing how am I going to make the switch? You know, you can't just make a 90-degree angle on a car. You have to kind of ease it in. But I also really did research on the Italian-American food and why is the Italian-American food different than what I know the regions of Italy. Well, and I went to across the United States in the Italian-American neighborhood, in Kentucky, in Kansas, all over. And the first big influx of Italian immigrants was at the end of the 1800s. And they basically came from Sicily, Calabria, and Campania, which is Naples, those three southern. So the Italian-American food really reflects a lot the southern culture. Mm. But having said that, you know, as much as I talk about that cuisine, the Italian cuisine depends on its products, they came here and they didn't have the products.
Right.
So the one thing that they did have, that they did find here, was garlic. That's why the Italian-American cuisine is full of garlic. You go to Italy, we don't use a lot of garlic. And, you know, it's part of that reflection.
The smell of cooking is garlic if in an Italian household in America.
Yes, but it's, you know, in Italy it is. We use garlic, but we're much more modified in a sense. We have, let's say, the Sunday sauce. The Sunday sauce here. Now, the tomato. The tomato is an American product. It was brought to Europe with Columbus. But the Italians, you know, they're farmers and whatever, the sun and whatever, the tomatoes there got nice and ripe. They were smaller. The tomatoes in America was pomodoro, golden apple. They were not even all red. They were the initial, they were yellow.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a bigger tomatoes. It was had a lot of juice and lots of seeds. And so the acidity was higher. The seeds have tannin. And the sauce became more bitter. Hence, here in the sauce, they add sugar.
Yeah.
You never add sugar in Italy in your sauce. That's a no-no. Absolutely. So, you know, they were adopting. Also, the Sunday sauce. You know, here you have a Sunday sauce. You have bracciole, meatballs, sausages, pieces of pork. In Italy, it's not like... In Italy, you have maybe a piece of cotica. Cotica is the skin, the salted skin, and a piece of fresh pork. And the tomatoes, and that's that, and it doesn't cook 3 hours. That's the Sunday sauce. But why? Because these immigrants came to the United States, and they didn't have meat in Italy. Here they found the abundance of meat. And hence, the Sunday sauce, they
full
put everything they had. It was their way of celebrating. And it still is, and it's a darn good sauce. I like it too, you know, and I have recipes for it and whatever. I actually went back and I... you know, picked up all the recipes and all of this and then worked at it. So that, you know, the two cuisines are parallel and they have a story. And it's a beautiful story in a sense, you know, of immigrants adapting to a situation. And then, of course, then there is the reality of regional Italian cooking, 20 regions. And even in Italy, the regions differ. A pasta fagioli is different in Le Marche than it could be in the Veneto. There's a little differences.
And you started traveling also around Italy as you after coming here, you started going back, right?
So, I realized because I was young, I didn't know all of the regions. I knew some of the northern regions. I went back and worked with chefs back to schools also. You know, we would take the vacation, we would close the restaurant and take a three-week vacation with the kids and all that and whatever, and go visit the family, and then each vacation, different region, made appointment with different chefs, with wineries, whatever, to really and continue. It still continues to this day.
I love that. Yeah, you know, in that that original MasterChef where you made the risotto for Giulia, you also made the rocchette with the sausage and the
broccoli. Di rape.
And that's really a Pugliese, southern dish,
Pugliese,
right?
Yeah. Pugliese.
I was surprised to see you make that. It's one of my favorite dishes. I love it.
Yeah, that's from Puglia, which is the heel of Italy. And, you know, that was early in my thing. So I had been there. I had learned that maybe a few years before that because that we don't cook in the north.
Right.
That pasta.
Yeah. But
now everything, Italy all over cooks, you know, all the pasta.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah,
it's blending more.
Well,
we have
the
internet.
Exactly. Everybody knows everybody.
Yeah. Wow. How are we doing on time? Are we good? A few more minutes? Okay. I have to say that you've written over a dozen cookbooks, and right, more than 12, I think. I tried to count. I couldn't
16.
Keep track. 16. Oh my goodness! And children's books, and that beautiful memoir. I think it's safe to assume that this is a room full of readers. If you have not read her memoir, I highly recommend it. But I think that this cookbook, and maybe I'm just being partial because I get to talk to you about it, but it feels really special to me. I feel like this cookbook feels like a celebration of your lifetime of cooking. Because I read through this and I see everything from there's the recipe for the Venetian style, the calf's liver and polenta, which you had bravely on the menu at Felidia, is in this cookbook. And yet you have turkey meatballs and rigatoni. And there's a salad with avocado. Yeah. Because your grandchildren love it?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
But this is all Lydia.
Well, the book, those of you that watched the show, my mother, who lived with me, who actually helped me raise my children, and she was there when we opened the restaurants and all that, she passed 2 years ago. And this is in her honor. But I get, on the internet, I get a lot of social media, I get a lot of emails from my viewers. And I do read them, and I do sort of respond to them. And they want to know more about the family, because my kids came on the show, because we lived in the same house, my grandkids then came. So, you saw, because it's been 25 years that I've been on television, so you saw my kids from little babies, grandkids, in the kitchen with me and growing up. So I get the questions, Lydia, what are the favorite recipes that you cook in your family, for your family? What does Joe like? What does Miles like? What was Grandma's favorite dish? And those are the dishes that I have here. And they do transcend the traditional,
yeah.
The one from my grandmother, they transcend into the Italian-American because, my kids love chicken parmigiana. Who doesn't?
Who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. and then on into the new addition. The salads, of course, now they have kale salads with avocado. This is the time. So that book reflects kind of this progression.
We are lucky. We're lucky because you have collected all of these things, and it's like, it's all you.
Yeah.
You've become just, I don't know, you've evolved, and this is so representative of it.
Right,
it's really
right.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's, I guess, it's not, it's, I always say, it's not me. I always have a team. There's always somebody that works with me to make things happen and so that I can reflect these things, because if I didn't have my grandkids to cook for or my, you wouldn't come up this thing. But yes, I'm blessed. I get excited. I get driven by the opportunity of getting them all around the table and cooking for them. And when they call me or they tell me, Nona, you're going to make this for me. I mean, I make soups now. I love making soups. And I have my whole freezer quarts. So three of my grandkids are away at college. Two have a little apartment. They graduated and they have. And when I come into the city or something, with my little bag, I do drop-offs of frozen soups. Nothing changes,
Should I give you my address? Okay, so we're going to let everyone else ask questions, but I'm going to ask you a cooking question first. So my favorite recipe that I have made, I showed you, I dog-eared about a dozen pages in this of recipes I'm excited to cook, but I have cooked a few of them. I loved your vegetable polpette. The vegetable meatballs are so good. And I know that this is a surprise coming from the butcher, but I've been eating less meat lately, and I just love to make meatballs. I told you, my nieces love to cook with me, and I get them to roll the meatballs. It's their favorite thing. So I want to make that recipe for my family sometime soon when I see them. But zucchini season is ending soon. Is there a vegetable that I can use in those meatballs? Something that would work as well? Would you still use the potato?
I think the potato is the kind of...
The starch.
That keep the glue, that keeps everything together. And I think that you could put in there whatever else. I think if you want to do even the Swiss chard. The greens and the starch. The question is, chop it or pass it through grinders, not too small, but so that it molds, so that your polpetta, your meatball doesn't crack open.
Okay.
And the potatoes keep it together. So, but you can make it with anything. You know, I always say about my recipes, you know, these are suggested products and whatever, but the beauty of it, what I really is when you guys out there make the recipe, follow my recipe, and then you go on your own. I encourage it. You know, what do you have in the house? Not always do you have in the house all the ingredients that I have in the recipes. So, you know, you improvise.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I loved the recipe for the chickpea and celery salad, but instead of the gorgonzola, I used a very nice local blue cheese. I thought you would appreciate that.
Yeah, that's it. That was good. Did you like it?
I loved it. I was actually on a recent recently looking at your old episodes, I watched you make a simple salad of just celery and artichoke.
Yeah.
And I've never eaten a raw artichoke. It blew my mind. I need to do that.
Oh, it's delicious.
Oh.
I would say, you know, in springtime. In the springtime.
It's not the season.
The small artichokes, when they don't have the choke yet.
Yeah.
So that you could really.
Tiny ones.
Yeah. And then the best thing is, you know, the mandolin, if we had to be careful. But
I'm terrified of the mandolin. I always wear the glove or use the accessory so I
don't
cut my
hand. Yeah, you could really slip. Absolutely.
All right. We have a microphone going around. Do we have questions? Do we have questions from the audience?
Philly is a big restaurant town. Where did you go to eat in Philly?
Ah, good question.
I didn't go anyplace. So I came because they had me booked. I did, I went to WHYY. I did, I did a radio. And then we taped a little discussion show. Then I went to Barnes & Nobles and signed their stock. And then across the street from Barnes & Nobles, by then, you know, it was already 1:32, they have like a baguette place, you know?
Did you go to Metropolitan Bakery, possibly?
No, it was just across from Barnes & Nobles, and my car was right there, so I got a tuna sandwich. How's that?
Do you eat Italian food when you travel, or do you like to experience other things?
I like to experience everything, but, you know, I'm a little bit more finicky with Italian food, so I have to really be ready.
That's what I thought.
But a tuna salad, you know, okay.
Yeah, doesn't disappoint.
No. And I like tuna.
I feel so blessed to be able to come to see you tonight. It's my birthday. This is a gift from my daughter.
Ah, Dennis, happy birthday.
I watched all your shows, read all your books, and you're a gift to the world. I was figuring somehow scheming to get into one of your restaurants to run into you sometime. Of course, that would be impossible. But I really wanted to thank you for being you and bringing it forward to us. And my wife says, you read all her stuff and you watch her shows all the time. I watched even before I came here today. But you never cook. I said, no. I watch the Golf Channel and I don't golf. But I think a big part of your show and what you represent and as valuable as your cooking is your family values. When I see you talk to your mother, your family gatherings, it's just very, very special.
Well, thank you. Thank you, because
thank
you. That is all part.
Yeah.
That is all part of who I am, what I believe in, and what I want to communicate. You see, as I said, I came here as a young immigrant, and I have a beautiful culture that I was born in. But then I was blessed and accepted in the American culture. And, you know, I am forever grateful to be here, to have been accepted. And, you know, I always find this, that maybe with food, with the family, I can connect my native country with my adaptive country. It makes it, you know, it's like you want to make family connect. And that's what I get even emotional, but I'm very grateful that I'm given this opportunity. And one would say, did you plan this? I didn't plan this. You know, I loved cooking. It was a sentimental thing that developed into, oh, I can do this. Oh, then I can be successful at this. The restaurant was successful. So also within all of this is the emotional, but it's also the financial, and we were talking about that. You know, made me live well, have a nice house. The family, everybody got educated. So in bringing this thing, but beyond that, my values are that because in the process of coming here, in the camp, we were just the four of us, the family, I had left all my family. You kind of, the Italians anyway, need that kind of group support. But specifically, our trips has made me understand how important family is. And then what I saw was in the emails that I got from you and all of that, is that, you know, people were longing for that. Somehow the modern world has scattered people, and the table can bring people together, you know. If you make a good meal, and it doesn't have to be a 3 or 4 course meal, but a good meal, a good plate of pasta or chicken parmigiana, whatever. And if you offer that, they will come. You know, if you cook, they will come. The table brings people together. So, you know, I felt this almost a little power. Oh, my God, you know, if I tell you to do this, they'll come. So do it. And you know, out there, there's really I feel the sensibility that people are really getting back together, and that's what America is looking for. You know, let's get back together. Let's get with the family. Let's respect that. And, of course, if I even had a little platform, you know, in that saying, I am very honored. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. Wow. I don't know how we keep going after that, but let's do it.
I'm just curious about the songs that Grandma sings at the end of your shows. Mm-hmm. Are the words written anywhere? That I'd just be interested in.
We don't have them written, but that's an idea. But they are traditional kind of songs. You know, every culture has the songs where they're sort of express in a very folkloristic way their passion, their happiness, their sorrows, and whatever. And these songs that she sings reflect that, you know. Family, like one of them, and I'll translate it, and she, bevevano I nostri padri, bevevano le nostre madri, e noi che figli siamo, beviamo, beviamo, beviamo. So, you know, this usually gets sung at the end when everybody's happy. So the question is, did our fathers drink? Yes. Did our mother drink? Yes. And we are the sons and daughters, so let's continue to drink. So that reinforces, you know, after you're at the table with everybody, you're just going, but that's all. And it has a nice rhythm and whatever. Yes, she passed away because she was always part of the show. She would come down. She lived upstairs. She would come down. She would come on the show. She would taste. And so I you know, I just couldn't leave her out because she's gone. And I have at the end little snippets of her, whether she sings. And we're going to continue to do that. And people love that. They sent me, you know, they write to me and say that they love seeing Grandma at the end. So she's always part of us singing.
I love that. How about right back there in the plaid shirt? Yeah.
Hi, thank you. So I have a food question for actually both of you, because I think it would be a good butcher question too. I am a firm believer in my heart of the whole nose-to-tail concept, not letting any part of an animal go to waste. But I have struggled to find any kind of offal that I enjoy eating, which makes me even more reticent to try and cook it. Reticent. So my question is, if either of you have any suggestions for a cut or a recipe that might be a good intro to offal.
Do you want to answer that first?
I have some answers.
Go ahead.
So, first of all, great. We should all eat from nose to tail if we're going to eat animals. But I would talk to my customers at the counter about this a lot, and I think that people have a hard time with the liver and the kidneys because that iron flavor is very intense. Heart is delicious. Heart is a muscle. So it's a little bit more similar to what you're used to in meat than the more different textures of the liver and the kidney, and it's a milder, it's more like eating a hanger steak. There's a touch of iron, but maybe, and I think you can cook heart so many ways. You can eat it raw or rare, like in a tartare, but you could also grind it and add it to your meatballs. And then everybody's eating a little organ meat, and they're getting a little extra iron, and they don't know. Also tongues. Tongues, I don't know, do you have any traditional recipes that you would cook with tongue? But tongue is also a muscle, so it tastes like a pot roast.
Yeah, we always cook. We cooked every part of the animal. Also the innards and all of these, the offals, are the first part. They go bad the fastest. Mm. And so they need to be sold the fastest. That's why when we slaughter an animal, my parents, the first thing was the blood. You cook the blood. And then you go on with the liver. That's very perishable and so on. And so you eat. So sometimes it's difficult, I guess. You know, it doesn't keep more than, I would say, 1 or 2 days. So to find it 2, 3 days, once you freeze it, whether it's liver or whatever, it changes textures and it's different. So it is difficult to get this offals at a good time in their sort of being fresh. The tripe, that's one that keeps because they give it one boiling first. So, you know, so if you buy the tripe has been boiled already once, and then you should cook it again. And sometimes they even put a little bit of chlorine in there to serve because it's an antibacterial and whatever, and they clean it. So some innards and all of that are, ears are cured, tongue can be cured, and their life, their sort of freshness can be extended. But a lot of the offals need to be super fresh too. Oxtails are good. You know, do you consider them or not? So ear, tongue could survive a little bit. The kidneys are not bad, but you know the kidneys always have that kind of
texture.
But also the urine flavor. It's there. It's permeating the whole thing. So you have to soak it in vinegar and whatever. You have to also know the treatments for those offals to get them to a palatable. You know, I mean, for us we were somewhat used to, but today you know. A kidney really stands out if you're not used to, and you need to know how to soak it in vinegar and then of course cook it with, again, mustard or something like that. That really gives it.
I think my advice is to use Lydia's recipes, honestly, because it's true. Like having any of those things not cooked well will turn you off of them forever. And I noticed in your recipe for the liver. The Venetian style liver, that you cook it separately so that you don't overcook it, and you keep it kind of rare, and then you add it, because if you overcook it, all the texture becomes kind of gritty and it's terrible. So she does have some, I would say maybe if you try her liver recipe you might like it, and also use a lot of fat, right? The trick to, I think, making the rich irony taste of the liver and thing tastes good is like butter and cream.
Yeah, and you know, here
that's also why everybody loves a pâté.
Onions, Veneziano, lots of onions, the sweetness
of the onions.
But it's also knowing how to, now, being a butcher, how to treat the organ, the liver. You have to go in and get the veins out. You know, you get slices of limb, but then you see the veins and all this. And also, it has a skin on the outside that you have to peel off. And you have to, otherwise, you know, you encounter this, all this resistance in your mouth. And, but you need, so it's, you know, it's awful. Maybe need more attention than the other cuts to prepare.
But yeah, sneak some heart into your cooking.
Heart is good.
Heart is good, right?
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much.
Yeah.
Okay.
So like you said, you've been doing this for 25 years. That means women like me here in America, I've been watching you since I was a child. And not only were you able to instill the love of food in me and the confidence in food that I became a professional chef and was able to work in food styling and TV. When did you come to realize your reach when going from opening restaurants here in America to knowing the position it would put you in to really touch women like me and inspire us to become chefs ourselves?
It's a progression. And taking the opportunities or the roads when they come. And when you do decide to take a road, I mean, look at all of the opportunities. Don't just make sure that you are prepared for that road that you want to take. And if you're not, then you need to invest again in yourself, or maybe surround yourself with people that could. But you have to believe in yourself. You have to have trust. You have to be prepared. You have to be professional. You have to be good at what you want to be. And if you're not there, then you continue. It's like schooling, a continuous schooling. I continuously, you know, go back to Italy, as I said, but, you know, work with chefs. I'm always curious to see what everybody, what other chefs are. But don't be afraid to look at an opportunity and possibly think of an opportunity. The one thing that is elementary here in the whole thing is that, yes, you have a passion. You love doing something. But unless you are successful financially, and we discussed that, you don't have a platform. You need to be, because in America, success is judged by financial. Being you made it, you live well, and whatever. It's not necessarily what is right or whatever, but especially in an industry like ours, so you have to also really surround yourself or be financially conscious, you know? Make sure that the next step you are successful, that, you know, the financial element that gets you out there, so you have a good product, you have something to give, you have an exchange with your audience, because it has to be, it's not all yours or whatever. You have to give value, quality, and also a setting, if you're dealing with food, for your customers to come back. They have to feel comfortable. They have to like what you do. You have to be open to what they say. So there's a lot of things and elements. I think that also being accepting and humble and, you know, listening to people, they will kind of tell you where you want to go. But I would encourage you, you know, don't be afraid. Invest in yourself, surround yourself with the right people, and make that first step. The first step will turn into second step, and so on down the line. I wish you good luck.
I got here a little bit early, so I had the chance to read the introduction to the book, and the love you have for your family, your grandchildren, your mom, your kids, really comes through. And you talk about what your mom's favorite dishes were and what the kids love, Lorenzo's favorite, Ethan's favorite, and so on. But what's your favorite?
What a great final question. What if you could pick just one? I know it's like asking you to pick your
like
favorite child.
Like asking me what's your child your favorite child.
No, I
at different times. You know,
today. You know, you had a tuna fish sandwich for lunch. If you could make dinner out of this cookbook, what recipe would you make?
I don't know. I can go for a linguine clams this time.
There you go.
Yeah.
I always.
Like it. But it's all about the seasonality. You know, what I get kind of excited and driven, even in cooking, but what I see, the food. It's, you know, the recipes are there, but when I see something, that kind of drives me to really want to cook when I see something real good. So now, you know, I'm getting into soups. I love making soups. You know, I love the whole squash family. The porcinis are coming out, lots of good mushrooms. So there's a lot to be done now in the fall. And when a product is good, then I respond to that product.
I love that. I just made my first soup of the season today. And also, the farmer's market is my favorite place on earth. You go there and you're inspired to cook.
It tells you what to cook.
Yeah. Ah, I love it.
Heather, I'm going to take a moment now, and I'm going to tell you how much I appreciate you as a woman.
Thank you.
As a woman choosing a profession that, unlike mine maybe, but yours is even harder for a woman, a butcher. I spoke to people how much you are appreciated in this city and how much you have done for the city and the farmers. So I want to congratulate you.
Thank you so much. You're going to make me cry. I just want to, Lydia, it has been like a joy, a huge joy for me to get to know you in advance of meeting you today and just reading your stories and spending time rewatching your shows. I mean, you were such a beautiful person, and I, as I was making my notes and thinking about asking you, I kept thinking that you seem so brave, and you are, but I think really you're generous, and I think that we all feel that, and your generosity and your love for food and family is like, you have just, for decades now, you've been sharing that, and it is so special. It really is.
Okay. Well, thank you, Heather.
Yeah, we're so lucky to have you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you all for coming. My pleasure.
you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.